Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Mit Wieso Steuer? Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 31, Episode 3. Coming up on the show, we've got Attack of the Monster Mind, the run-in with Chile's Electric Man, and the Kiwi Death Ray cover-up. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Happy Australia Day.
Yeah, happy Australia Day to you, my compatriot.
Nice to be here on this lovely day where, of course, we follow the time-honoured Australian tradition of bashing New Zealand.
That's right. Finding the weirdest Kiwi we can and showing how... They are a representation of the entire nation of New Zealand. Just a bunch of weirdos. Which is why we've got the glorious Australian flag
at like
the bottom
it.
There.
It's a nice touch. Well done.
Australia Day. Everyone, the building's completely dead. We're the only ones here. Everyone else is out having fun. And like every year.
Every year. We always work on public holidays. It's the way that it goes.
We're in here.
It's all right.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about Victor Penny. Fascinating story. This was a guy, self-taught engineer. Who, there was an article in 1935 featured in, it was some newspaper, like The Star or something in New Zealand. And it was an interview with his lawyer. And his lawyer was explaining an experiment he had done about 6 months prior, where he had been sitting in his workshop and noodling with some experimental machine he was working on. And he flicked a switch on his machine and he had just started smoking a cigarette, and as soon as he flicked the switch on the machine, his box of matches, which was like a foot away from him, just burst into flames. And he was like, what the hell's going on? So he did more experiments, and according to his lawyer who was interviewed in this article, he managed to repeat this experiment where he could remotely detonate this box of matches.
Now, so it sounds like he's building a laser?
The press dubbed this a death ray.
Mm-hmm. The heat ray.
Yeah, we'll go into some of the history of that term and why it was really the go-to term for anything electrical, any kind of electrical effect in the 1920s and 30s. It was called a death ray. But what made this story really fascinating is that the reason the newspaper was interviewing his lawyer and not him is because the night before, or just a few days prior, Victor Penny was found nearly beaten to death at his place of work. His co-workers came upon him. He was clearly pummeled. He had, you know, broken bones all over, fractures in his jaw. He was half conscious, and he was mumbling about secret plans.
That he'd come across?
Well, this was what started the all these rumors swirling around this guy. He ended up being moved to hospital, actually. He was in hospital for 6 months, but he was under police protection 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Okay. Now, the police tried to say that this was just a random mugging, that it wasn't anything to do with national security.
Yeah, but you don't get police protection if you just had a random mugging.
But yeah, why did he have police protection? And after he got out of hospital, he disappeared. We'll be talking about that coming up in our Plus extension later on. Okay. What have you got coming up for our Australia Day special? What New Zealand content will you be doing?
Well, I was going to bash New Zealand, but I thought, oh, you know what? I'm going to give them a break this year. I'll just lay off a little bit. And so we'll pick on Chile. So
Great.
We're going to go into, actually, I'm just joking. I picked up this really fantastic book that I've used ChatGTP to actually translate. I did start with ChatGTP 4, but then I ran out of credit. I don't know what happened. And I was just like, okay, we're back to 3. So
there's a hard limit on how many contextual relationships you can get.
And it was so much slower to use 4 in comparison to 3. So I was like, you know what?
You know what you do? The best way around it is you pay for the API and you just pay like a fraction of a cent per character. And you can chuck in like 10,000 words.
Oh, really?
You can choose different GPT levels.
Okay. Well, we might do that.
I'll show you how to do that.
Thank you.
I'll do it. We can do it now if you want.
No, it's completely beside the point for this episode. My point is, and this is something that we've said over the years, and this is why it's actually so exciting, that you know, I've got a lot of fear when it comes to AI, but we've always said, Ben, that there is this wealth of stories all around the world in relation to high strangeness phenomena, paranormal phenomena, unexplained experiences, all that kind of stuff, which is locked up because it's in languages that you and I don't speak.
Care?
Yeah. Well,
it's not only languages you and I don't speak, it's languages that you and I can't pronounce.
No, exactly. Yeah. And I
have any hope of ever understanding.
I know. It's just, it's amazing. Like, it's, I really have a lot more respect for people that speak multiple languages now.
Like, we can't even do Spanish impressions. We can just say care.
Care. That's pretty much, I can't even do that. So, although I can today, because we're going to be talking about Scott Corrales. I can pronounce that. He referenced, I was talking about an article he did earlier in the year where he was describing a book written by Chilean author George Anfrons. And George Anfrons wrote the book Ovnis, and I've actually got the proper translation here, because Ovnis apparently stands for Objectos Voladores No Identificacionados. Something like that.
Just perfect. Give up, dude.
That's just perfect. But essentially, it's extraterrestrial UFOs and others in Chile. And so this has only been published in Spanish. And so, of course, I pulled it out. And this book is just jam-packed with incredible encounters and stories. Because it's not just about UFOs. It's also, from the title, about others as well.
Right.
And when I say others, it includes gigantic electric men and strange interdimensional rifts. And, of course, this is why I got this attention. Like, this book came to my attention is because when Scott was describing it, if you recall, he was talking about people that had encounters with extra-dimensional cities. And this is where, you know, George was meeting with people that have had strange experiences, but usually transport workers, for example, bus drivers, truck drivers, people that follow very regular routes that know the landscape like the back of their hand. And then suddenly they'll have this dramatic experience where they'll drive through a ultra modern city that they've never seen before, which is like all of a sudden sprung up something that would take years to build.
So it's not like a mirage in the sky or anything.
It's not a mirage.
The light reflecting off the lake.
No, they're actually driving through it.
They're in some other place.
And as was described by George and referenced by Scott Corrales, was that with these lands, these interdimensional locations, it seems that the door swings only in one direction for the most part. And this is apparent actually when I started digging through the book, because it became quite obvious that, and I will expand on some of the stories because all the details weren't included there, but it kind of highlights the point that these entities seemingly know all about us, but we don't know about them. And so when people have experiences of going into these spaces, it's almost like these beings are like, oh, no, you can't be here, and then try to get people out. And they actually like lock their doors at their cars and, you know, send them on their way. And then other times, of course, people have terrifying encounters with them where they try to smash into their vehicles and things like that. So all of that we're going to go into and then possibly cross into the idea of this, you know, being, and what was highlighted in these particular stories, and this is where it all kind of jumped from, was that with these extra-dimensional experiences, and apparently it relates to an area called Arica, which is in the northern part of Chile.
Why does that ring a bell?
Well, that particular area has bodies of water, but the bodies of water themselves have a lot of strange activity associated with it, with cryptids coming out of it, UFOs flying out of them, things disappearing, strange disappearances.
Didn't we cover a book from a young guy who traveled there?
I believe
specifically
so.
To research that area.
Yeah, well, what's fascinating about that particular area, and you know, another of these stories that come up, is that while the soil itself apparently isn't very rich in minerals, there's veins, there's deep veins of pyrite all through these regions. And it just so happens, and this is the idea, that these veins are somehow attracting the phenomenon. Now, whether or not it's that it's somehow naturally permitting an opening of a doorway between the realities, maybe. The other idea that's been put out there is that it's just attuning some people's brains to be able to see the phenomena, which is always there. And so truck drivers, bus drivers, for example, you know, you may know the area very well, but all of a sudden you're tired, like you're exhausted, you've been working so long, you've been working Australia Day, and all of a sudden, because you're in a certain mind state, and the exposure to those minerals or the fields that they give off, it of course attunes you to be able to see these things. The other possibility as well is that it's just causing hallucinations. But then you have to question, if it's causing hallucinations, why is it, especially with the stories I'm going to describe for you, why is it that so many of these hallucinations are similar? Like, why are people seeing the same kind of things? And it's not just in Chile, it's actually all around the world. So I want to jump into these stories, but just before we do, so in our Plus extension coming up towards the end of the show, Ben, you're going to be describing a New Zealand guy. Have you got anything else coming up?
We might watch the 1988 Bicentenary Australia Day celebration video, but it's like...
Isn't that 3 hours?
It's like 4 hours long. We can watch it if you want.
Why not? Why did we not do it for this show?
Do a little. We can do a little preview.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I think I've got something. Do I have something queued up? There we go. Remember this?
Oh, it was a different world.
This was our country.
This is when we were happy. I was 4 years old, I think.
Got the Formula One, The Rock. People celebrated. People loved this country.
People were patriotic. People loved their country.
Look how proud we were as a nation.
And look at how we
as
were
a people.
In bringing in other cultures and celebrating
it.
We had
trannies on the catwalk, people on horses, AB, Formula One cars, boats, surfers, waving arms, ballerinas, music.
So are we going to mourn today?
Drum boys, planes, some guy with a beard, some prego lady, some guy in front of a house.
Where's Dame Edna?
Confetti. Aboriginal rock. Oh, take me back.
It's almost 40 years now. We can't go back. All right, let's jump into these stories. We're going to go into Onvis, the experiences described by George Anfrunz, and of course, some of his earlier stories. So one of the stories I described, which I didn't go into in great detail because it wasn't fully translated, was the story of a young guy that seemingly went into one of these other realities, wherever it was. And when he did, he brought back an item. And I think in that story, I was describing that he brought back a spoon. Like he took so it was able to prove that it was actually a physical location that he went to. And it just so happens that the spoon apparently was, the purity of the silver was so high that it was, you know, questionable as to, well, where did he get this?
Was it a smart spoon?
Well, it wasn't a smart spoon.
An ice spoon?
The silver, though, was such a high purity that it couldn't have come from, you know, melting down jewelry from coinage. Like, it had to have come from other...
And let me guess, the spoon went missing shortly after this?
Yes, it did. Yeah, of course. Yeah, every single... And a lot of these stories are like that, where people collect materials, but the people that have the materials, either the material itself disappears... Mm. Or the person who has it dies in mysterious circumstances.
Every single time.
Well, this story was about Eladio, who was a young boy of 14 years old. Now, it's important to note with these stories is that many of these people, they're illiterate. Like, they're uneducated or undereducated, and they're illiterate. And yet somehow they come back from these locations describing these incredible stories. And on this particular story, no date is given, but I assume from the referencing of these stories, it must have been the 1960s, somewhere in that range. But he claims that one day he goes out on his rowboat fishing. He borrows a boat to go fishing, and he rows towards the eastern end of this lake. Now, the details of the lake are not included, but I wonder if it's the same one from Arica that many of these experiences occur. And it could just be because of the translation, or I'm not exactly sure what's going on. But regardless... He goes out and he has this great day hoping for a great haul. And as he's going out, he says there's this cloud that starts to accumulate around him. It's like kind of attracted to him, and it's like getting in the water and it's all around him. And he says it somehow draws him in. It's not that he wants to even get away from it. He feels like he has to go to it. So he goes to it and he says this cloud just all of a sudden envelops the boat, and he's lost all sense of direction. Now he's actually quite disoriented, starting to panic a little bit. But he says as he's panicking, he realizes that he's got his oars up, like he's lifted his oars up because he doesn't want to keep moving. But then he notices the boat is still moving, like he's still being propelled along by some force which is behind him. It's almost like you can feel it pushing down in the back of this boat. And he claims that all of a sudden he comes to a shore. Like he comes to this shore, but it's different from anything he knows. He says there's a pier, and behind this pier is this beautiful city. And at the top of the pier, he sees these strangely dressed people, and he says they're colonial style. And he gets out of the boat and he wanders up and starts talking to them, but they're ticked off. Like, they're like, you shouldn't be here. Like, how did you manage to get here? But this tall blonde woman intervenes, and apparently she's of this strange beauty, and she speaks Spanish, like fluent Spanish, but she's clearly not Spanish. He's like, there's something off about this, but she intercedes on his behalf, and she invites him into the town, and apparently the town wanted nothing to do with him, like wanted nothing at all to do with him. But he's just so in awe, and also, you know, it's awe, but there's also, I think, a sense of apprehension about where he is. And he's taken to the home of this lady, and he says that when he was taken there, few people talk to him, but he's treated like a museum specimen. And the lady acts as this gracious host, but there was still something a little bit off.
Are they acting like they understand how he's arrived there?
Yes.
And they're just annoyed by it?
Absolutely.
So yeah, it's not anything mystical to them. It's not some kind of miracle. They're just like, oh.
Well, it's almost like, it feels like she's violated some social contract not to interact with these people. But obviously she's taken pity upon this boy. And perhaps it's because of his age, like he's 14 years old. Maybe that's why. But he says that the table is unlike anything he's seen before. He says it's movie-like tableware. And I don't know, again, if that's the translation, but it's of this enormous size and weight. Like the spoons are huge. The knives and forks are much bigger. Not so big as he can't hold them.
How big are these people again?
Oh, they're kind of normal size, but just the proportions of this table is
they just like large cutlery, large salt and pepper.
It's like in the 90s where those massive glass, like chunky wine glasses were all popular. That's right. What's going on here. So apparently he's told to go to bed early and he's not to leave the house. And he's told absolutely not. Now he does as he's told. And the next morning, this delegation apparently of tall blonde men accompany him to the pier. Like they escort him.
Electric men?
Not electric men, just normal men, right? Okay. But they escort him to the pier. And it even says here that they bid him farewell very politely, but with very cold features. It's like they're angry but courteous at the same time. I'm like, okay. Like, so you can tell, like, there's this tension that's going on. Now he claims that once again he's enveloped by this cloud and he comes back out and he finds himself he's rowing and he kind of drags himself to the shore. Like he's once again back on the shore. And the owner of the boat that he'd borrowed, like he hadn't stolen it, he had borrowed it. The owner of the boat comes running down and he's really angry. He's like scolding him. He's like, where have you been? You've been gone for 3 days.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
And he's like, I haven't.
Off with the fairies.
I've been gone. It's got a very much fairy, you know, fae folklore kind of feel to this. He's like, I haven't been gone for 3 days. I've been gone for one. And he's like, no, you've been gone for 3 days. But he apologizes and he starts telling the story. He says, this cloud threw me to the other side of the lake. And people just started laughing at him. They branded him an alcoholic. Mm. Again, he's 14 years old, so I don't know how that happens, but he's branded as an alcoholic. But what's fascinating about this is perhaps the physiological effects is because he's exhausted. Like he's absolutely exhausted to the point where he lays in bed the next day, the entirety of the day. Like he's so overwhelmed by this. And he's trying to understand what had taken place, what really happened. Now, look, here's the corny part of the story. He reaches into his pocket because he suddenly remembers that he'd taken a spoon. Now, he pulls out from his pocket this spoon and he runs down to the town's jewelry store and he asks them to analyze it. Now, the jeweler uses apparently standard acid tests and says to him, where did you get this? And this is a big spoon. Right, I don't know exactly how big it is, but it's large. Like it's a big ass spoon.
It's a big novelty spoon.
It's a big novelty spoon, exactly. And unlike what was from the previous translation, and maybe this is just because, again, GTP, but it's not made of silver. It's made of pure gold. Like it's the highest purity of gold. And what's kind of sad about this, right, is again, 14 years old, not great at making financial decisions. He doesn't actually know the value. He knows gold's valuable, but not how valuable it is. And God, if it's this massive novelty spoon, who knows how many ounces it is, but let's say it's in the thousands, he sells it for a lousy price. Mm. Like the jeweler completely undercuts him and he takes the money and he returns to the pier where he borrowed the boat. He buys another boat with the money that he got from the spoon, right? And from there, he begins to go out every morning in search of that strange place. 2 years later, he completely vanishes from the area.
What?
Just completely, he's gone. Boat never comes back. He never comes back. Now, the legend goes is that some people suspect that he just left the area, that he just gave up, that he was this alcoholic and that he had this, complete strange dream. And but others have suggested that, no, he'd actually spent his time doing... I'm sorry, I said this was the 60s. This happened in the early 40s.
What's the name of the lake again?
The lake is the... And I did write it down here.
Because the book I was thinking of that we covered a lot, maybe over 2 years ago now, was Paranormal Expeditions Hunt for the Friendship. And this was from Chaz. Remember Chaz of the Dead?
I do. Yes, of course.
He was that young researcher who...
Great book.
Read this stuff and just thought, I'm going to go out there and find out for myself. So he went to Lake Colburn.
No, it's not Colburn.
In Chile.
It's funny that you should mention that, though, because that, I believe, does come up in one of the stories. But no, this particular lake, and I put it down lower in my notes, Langquihue. Langquihue.
Okay.
Langquihue. So But that's one of many lakes that are also mentioned but not directly referenced.
His research technique was to sit down at the lake and then just take a ton of LSD.
Okay, so that's, right.
Get in touch with the aliens.
Right, yeah, and I remember that. And I remember I was, healthily skeptical about it, but I'm also willing to entertain that perhaps, these substances are possibly, shortcuts to viewing these realities. Maybe that's what's going on.
Oh, yeah, that's the next place he goes in the book.
There you go. Right.
Lan Kuei Hue.
Yeah, Lan Kuei Hue. So it's a real hotbed of activity. And one of the suspicions is the reason for that is because of that pyrite vein that's near it.
Right.
Because, of course, there are stories of UFOs landing near it, weird entities climbing out, collecting samples.
But that description you just went through matches everything to do with the friendship, this so-called group tall, blonde extraterrestrials. And the idea was that they had an island just off the coast, and there were reports that some of the locals thought they were Germans or something, but they definitely weren't from that area. But occasionally they would turn up in town and they'd want to trade. They'd want supplies. They'd want
food. And they had gold.
They'd want fresh water. And they always traded with large amounts of gold. Not ingots, but nuggets of gold.
Nuggets, sorry, yeah.
Or sometimes strange coins, according to different reports. But in that case you just shared, you've got the gold, you've got the tall blondes, you've got this strange, obscured location that they're from. The friendship was supposedly from an island that couldn't be found.
Yeah.
It's the same idea, isn't it?
Isn't that fascinating? Story. So this book, I believe, came out in 92. So there's a possibility that maybe this has picked up, kind of like a folkloric kind of edge to it. But I don't know. There's something strange here. So actually, speaking of that lake, okay, so now we actually go to, we'll go back to Long, is it Q? Long Q? Long May Q. But with this particular...
Well, Q-U-E is Ke.
Oh, is it Ke? Again, I sincerely apologize to all of our Spanish-speaking listeners. I am butchering it. I do apologize. But this is a story from 1976. And in fact, many of these stories all kind of relate to the mid-70s, which is fascinating because it indicates that there seemed to be an uptick in activity at that time. It relates to the story of Mr. Carlos, who was a manager at a machinery importing company, and he was assigned to transport goods, and he basically had this Chevrolet pickup, and he takes his car, and much like the previous story, right, he's driving along this road, and he knows it very well, but it's got deep valleys and high mountains, and he's kind of traveling, and he says all of a sudden, when he's on this stretch of lonely road, he's pulled by some unknown force, it's as if the road was opening up. He says he looks ahead, and instead of there being a pavement, he sees this lush green grass, and it kind of grabs his attention and he's staring at it. But then all of a sudden his gaze is lifted because he looks up to this marvelous city right before him, which is not on any map. So this is one of these weird interdimensional cities, right? So the pickup truck continues to drive towards this beautiful garden, and it's jolting because of this sudden force, and he discerns these silver towers and streets that gleam like gold. It's written, children playing with untamable beasts of some kind.
What?
I don't know if they've got weird cat pets. And I thought about it because there was a reference
to... Is this just GPT being ridiculous?
No. This is GPT was ridiculous at some points, but I said, no, make this a direct translation. But I thought about this, right? And this will come up later on. Because these children are playing what appear to be big cats, right? What in this particular area, but also all around the world, there's reports of people encountering phantom black cats. And I'm like, well, is this maybe what's happening in some of these circumstances? That they're just the natural fauna of another interdimensional realm, and they occasionally come through for people. This could explain where they exist, where they inhabit. But as this guy's Mr. Carlos is driving along, he says this tall figure appears before him, and his pickup truck has come to this stop, and this tall figure is like right up against the window of the car, like right up against the door. So he's like trying to open the door. And as he tries to open the door, the being's just like with his hand, shoves his hand forward without touching anything, and some force keeps the door locked.
Is this another tall blonde?
It doesn't say he's blonde. It just says he's a tall being. But I wonder if it's the same kind of thing. But again, this being speaks pure
high
Spanish.
German.
Not high German. Pure Spanish. And he says, are you lost? And Carlos responds with, well, where am I? And he says, you'll know in time, children push. And to his astonishment, the pickup just starts reversing until it goes back to the initial point on the road where it was. And simultaneously, the city, the children, and the adult dematerialize right in front of him.
What did he bring back, a fork or a knife or?
No, nothing like
a
that.
A ladle?
Nothing like that as far as I'm aware. But he's kind of like lurched over the steering wheel. He's panting. He's got palpitations. He has, again, these physiological effects of being in this other place. Now, of course, fear, anxiety, you know, excitement, all those things can cause that. But I wonder if this is some sort of side effect of moving through these realities.
It's honestly just making me think of Simon Young's fairy census and those stories we covered before the end of the year with the cases of individuals going into these other locations. The weather changing suddenly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hearing voices in the air and finding themselves in another dimension. And often the descriptions, they were saying they were elves and fae folk, but they're not dissimilar to what you're describing.
Not at all.
I mean, they're not the kind of fairy tale depictions that we're used to seeing in the fairy tale books. They're kind of 2 to 3 feet tall, sometimes taller, very human looking individuals.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head with that. They're very human looking in all of these stories, apart from the weird electrical men. They're all very human looking, right? So with Carlos, though, the story doesn't end here because he returns to, I think it was Concepcion. And when he goes back it sounds very French, doesn't it?
Yeah, what a pronunciation.
And he keeps his experience to himself because he's obviously, you know, something like this, he must have hallucinated. He must have had, you know, a wild experience. A year later, it's 77. He's traveling along the same road. And as he's traveling along the road, he begins to feel something hitting his car. Like there's something starts hitting his car.
What do you mean tapping it?
Like a force, like an energy. Like something has kind of pushed his car. And the car starts sinking into the road. The car just starts sinking down. As he's driving along, the car just starts sinking down into the road. Sweat starts pouring from every pore. His mouth fills with saliva. His heart's racing.
Is this like one of those videos from China where there's just this huge gaping hole in the road?
No, it's not a sinkhole.
And they sink into it.
Yeah, not a sinkhole from corrupt construction. No, so this he crouches down because he doesn't want to see what's going on, but he knows this feeling because he's felt it before. It's familiar, right? Not only is the experience and the feeling familiar, but so is the voice. He looks up, his car stopped, and this voice, this being, is just standing, this tall being standing next to the vehicle. He's like, oh, back again.
Huh?
And Carlos is like, yeah, but this time I'm getting out. And straight away, the being's like, you can't, don't even try. Don't even
try. What does he keep ending up in this location?
Isn't it weird, right? So he's rattling his door, his car door, he's trying to get out. And he says that there's no one blocking it. Like there's no one there because he jumps over to the other side, his passenger side. No one's there, but it's still locked. Like he can't get out. And this adult once again calls the children who push the vehicle backwards. But when they say that they're pushing the vehicle backwards, I don't think they're touching it. Like they're, again, using some force. And everything once again disappears, just like his first experience. The city, the children, the adult, and the streets that shine like gold all disappear. Now, obviously, this is the second time that's happened. So this is either a very bad hallucination, but it's weird that you would have the same hallucination twice. There's something else going on. So he goes to see his doctor, like he's got a doctor friend.
Oh, this will fix it.
And he goes to see the doctor. The doctor listens attentively and he's like, oh, yes, you know, what an incredible
experience.
We've got
something for that. Let me write you a prescription.
Valium and restorative. I don't know what the restorative is, but Valium is a sedative, all right? So he takes the sedative and he's like, it doesn't do it. It doesn't provide tranquility. Of course, you know, these barbiturates, whatever they are, doesn't work. But it happens that years later, he's hospitalized with this critical condition. It's this very threatening intestinal obstruction. Oh. No one knows what it is. They can't work it out. And in the night, he doesn't have any drugs on board. That same adult that's been at both of the experiences standing next to the car door is now standing in the corner of his hospital bedroom.
Wow.
And he's
dressed as Doogie Howser.
It doesn't say how he's dressed. It just says that the being comes over and advises him to refrain from the operation. That's all he says, just a simple, you need to refrain
from
the operation.
Does he just really need to go to the toilet? Is that what the problem was?
Maybe. And maybe that's exactly what's happening at this whole thing.
Really constipated.
Because the next day, Carlos vehemently refuses the surgical intervention. He signs papers withdrawing from the procedure at his own risk, and weeks pass, and he doesn't die. Like, he doesn't die. Now, he goes to the hospital for a checkup, and they had taken x-rays before and there was an obstruction. Like it was on the x-rays and the only way they could get it out was through surgery. The x-rays are taken of the affected area and the doctor scratches his head. He says, what did you do? What did you take? Carlos answers truthfully. He's like, nothing. I didn't do anything. The doctor's like, well, I don't know how to explain this, but it's disappeared as if by magic. And Carlos is like, just like the city, the children, the beasts, and the strange adult who advised me to not undergo the surgery. It all just disappeared. So what do we make of this? Is it that these beings are somehow looking after him because he ventured into their realm? Did he get a spoon lodged in his backside when he was there to smuggle it out?
What is the reasoning behind his special treatment? Because the story sounds like he's just randomly wandering into some dimensional rift, some rip in space-time. But why are they looking after him?
Yeah, it crosses almost into, not directly, but it does have like a abduction feel about it. You know how like the stories of people that are abducted and later on, you know, they have like they're healed or they have miraculous recoveries, but usually that's because the program needs them. You know, it's so.
We covered a story like that last year where the entities were a similar description, tall, blonde, but they were pretending to be Mormons. They were pretending to
be Mormon, space Mormon
missionaries.
Yeah.
But they were turning up when she was at hospital and there's this hot blonde guy. He was the doctor. But really, he was one of these entities.
Where is it? I threw this away because it's just because I didn't do the full story. Where was it? What was her name?
You're scrunching up good
material. No, it's not that it's good material because I couldn't get it to translate. What was it? Oh, it was Monica. Yeah, okay. So this one I didn't even bother to include because it was just a throwaway, literally a throwaway one. But Monica had an experience that was very similar in the sense that she had been driving along a lonely road. From what I recall, she encountered something that appeared to be UFO-like she went through like some type of rift, but when she went through the rift, she found herself strapped to a gurney of some kind. And these beings were healing her. They were doing something, right? And it just so happens that she did later on, when she came out of this and she found herself in hospital because I'd found her wandering somewhere. And when they treated her, apparently she was suffering from some illness, but after this experience, she was totally recovered. And like these are these weird, spontaneous cases where people are pulled into other rifts and are healed. Like it really doesn't make any sense. But continuing in this vein of these sorts of stories, you've got the story of Jamie Troncoso. Now, this is odd because this seems to be the opposite of healing and helping people. He left his home. We don't know why. I'm assuming that there was something, for whatever reason, that was driving him to go because he only had enough money for a one-way ticket, but he wanted to leave. He arrives at this station, at this random town. He gets out and he's got nothing. Like he's just got basically the clothes on his back. And he starts wandering around looking for a job advertisement because he's unemployed, he's in this new area. And while he previously hadn't been suicidal, apparently the idea of suicide just comes into his mind. Like it just suddenly is there, which is strange. Now, as he's wandering about, he actually encourages himself to keep walking and keep searching for a job. Now, he comes towards the Entel Tower, right? And he says that as he comes towards the tower, he begins to perceive that the view of the cityscape, which was there before, suddenly starts dissolving into nothingness. He lost the surroundings, the people, the vehicles, the streets, the tower, everything, until he's left floating in a white blank space.
Oh, he's in the Matrix loading room.
Pretty much, except the Matrix loading room is aboard a UFO. Because next thing he knows is he says he finds himself inside a ship of some kind with visors and knobs. An entity gives him a warning about his life and a crucial date. He begins to float still in this white void once again and then discovers himself sitting on a bench in the town square near the subway exit. It's now 10 o'clock at night. So he's arrived there at 4:30 in the afternoon.
So missing time.
Missing time for hours and hours and hours. 5.5 hours is missing. He doesn't know. But for whatever reason, he's like, I got to go home now.
How many of the stories in this book would you say are simply alien abduction-esque?
That's a good question. I feel like a lot of them are, but then they've also got this interdimensional kind of feel to it. I mean, that's one of the only cases where we hear of a craft. Of course, there are, like in this particular section of the book, of course, the book is full of experiences of people seeing craft, but people actually interacting with these realms, these spaces. That's the only one that I pulled out that has a reference to a vehicle of some kind, a spaceship, I mean, like a UFO. But what's weird for this guy is that he returns home, like he feels like he has to go home. Everything's changed for him. And he actually believes that he's no longer the same as he was before.
What do you mean? Like Berenstain Bears, everything's changed? Like it's a subtly different universe?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like he's come back. It's like he's come back to the wrong place. And he said the idea of being alone from now terrifies him. Like it completely terrifies him. So it's like, what is happening to these people? Are they coming back? Like, do we live in a multidimensional realm? Like, is that what's going on? And they brought him back to the wrong place. Like it's close, but not close enough.
You're talking about the multi-universe idea.
Yeah, yeah.
He's come back to a slightly different layer.
Like, why would he suddenly have this feeling of suicide?
Like Vegemite tastes like Nutella, and that's the only difference.
That would be hell, but yes, that's exactly what's going on. Then we have the case of Don. So Don apparently was a distinguished member of the army. I don't know what his rank was because it actually GTP just said, a distinguished member of the army with the rank of Don.
Colonel Don.
I'm like, oh, okay. A non-commissioned officer stationed in Eureka. So we're still in this area, right? Again, takes his pickup, takes his wife out in this pickup. They have this pleasant journey. There's this northern breeze that renews their desires. They arrive at this abandoned citadel, which was this driving force of the mining past of northern Chile. And he gets there with his wife and basically he'd set up this romantic kind of interlude thing. And he'd set up the back of the pickup truck to be this like lovely, satisfying table, you know, for a picnic essentially on the back of the truck. And they have their picnic and they rest up. He takes his camera out and they wanted to go for a wander through this abandoned now village. And they're taking photos of the houses and the pavilions and the surrounding area. And the sun and the hours start to pass and sun sets. And the wife says to him, she's like, oh, because I've gone away from their vehicle, right? And as I've gone away from their vehicle, she's like, oh, I don't know why, but there's some kid that's been lingering around the truck. Like he's been there for a while. And immediately Don's like, oh, I've got a firearm in the glove box. So I don't want the kid, you know, if he gets into the car, if he finds the gun, he might accidentally shoot himself or God knows what he'll do because he left the vehicle unlocked. So they go running back, well, not running back, but they're going back to the car. They see this potential danger in the child opening the glove compartment. And they slowly walk towards the vehicle. And when they're just meters away from the child, they realize that it's not a child. It's a small diminutive being wearing a black jumpsuit and a helmet who had a reflective visor on it that cast out beams of light. Now, I'm not sure if it was reflecting from the sun as it was
or
setting.
Glowing eyes or something.
They're not sure what it is, right? But initially, Don thinks it's the son of a neighbor from Eureka because he was dressed in the style of like a BMX kind of, he thought he's like a BMX rider, but he's like, that's not a BMX rider. That's not. And he says that as he's watching this kid, he's only 3 meters away from him. As he's 3 meters away, the kid starts dissolving in upon himself.
What is
that?
The
entity starts dissolving into the space.
Recreate it for us on the video.
Oh, I can't do that. But basically, I mean, I wish I could use AI to do this, is that think of seeing a solid form. This is the thing. It's a solid human-style form just suddenly start disappearing into the space that it occupies. Like it's dissolving into itself.
Let me try. Like
that. Yeah, but then like little, like made of little balls, all the balls kind of sparkling as it shrinks into itself. But of course, you know, the wife is completely, like he's obviously freaked out, but the wife loses it and she can't bear the shock. She falls into a hysterical state and he rushes her actually to back into the town. And apparently, like, they were so terrified that as they're driving, like, all the picnic stuff in the back of the truck is being thrown about and she's screaming. And finally, they get to the doctor and the medical professional, you know, checks upon her and they admit all details of what happened. She just explains that she's hysterical. But we don't really know what happens to her. Apparently, she calms down and she's okay. But 48 hours later, without telling his wife, Don decides to go back to that spot because he wants to know what it is. He's like, what was that? And that makes sense, right? It makes sense that you would go there. So he drives back up. And he says when he gets to where his vehicle was, he can find the tire tracks of his car. And right next to the car, he distinguishes several footsteps that are corresponding to what appears to be a child's shoe. But beyond that area, he discovers this circular mark. It's 6 meters in diameter, and there are 3 indentations in the ground. These indentations have this petroleum-like color in them and a burnt smell that's in the sand. Like it's just in that one particular area itself. Now, his wife is so freaked out by this that she refuses to ever leave the Eureka area ever again, except for a major reason. But this is reported directly. And Don says that, you know, he's the only person who's told this, you know, this experience about, but apparently it was referenced by other people. And they were, you know, quite convinced in his sincerity about what he had experienced. And, you know, it's written by George. He says, you know, for him, this was a real experience. It wasn't fictional. But what did they
Jorge,
experience?
You mean?
I don't know what this is. I don't know what this is.
Jorge Eduardo.
Maybe. I mean.
What do you mean maybe? It's Jorge. It's
oh, is it Jorge?
George.
Oh, it's Jorge. Oh, there you go. Oh,
you
I'm sorry.
Pronounce it George.
I didn't have to know you had that up. I thought you were talking about the witness, like a Don. No, okay. Oh, there you go. Jorge. So then we go to Sergio. So Sergio was a truck driver.
It's pronounced Sergio.
Sake. That's fine. We'll go with Sergio. We'll go with Serge. So Sergio. Serge. Good old Serge. Again, a truck driver. And this is what many of these stories.
It's a freaking igloo in here, and I'm going to turn up the aircon.
Oh, my God.
Keep going. Don't stop on my accord.
So, Sergio, he, again, a truck driver. And this is the odd thing about this is like many of these stories relate to people when they're in remote locations and isolated locations. It's weird not talking to you. It's like people know you're not there. So anyway, this guy is driving along in his Mercedes, but stop freaking out. It's just freaking me out. If you're listening, you don't know what the hell's going on. I don't think you want to. So go back. We'll start.
He doesn't
from the
like being touched.
No, don't. Maybe I am suspecting. My other
like
half
it.
Told me that today. I was like, okay.
Doesn't
thanks
like a
much.
Little rub on the shoulders
don't,
from an electric man. You know, like a little rub on the
I
shoulders
don't like loud
in Australia
noises either. So you know, but anyway, we go to this good old Serge. He's driving in this remote location. It's late at night. He's driving his Mercedes-Benz truck, but he's going along cheerfully. He's got his companion. Topo is his companion's name. I don't know if that's a real name or a pseudonym. Topo.
It's pronounced Tupo.
Tupo. So as they're driving along, they've got many kilometers of conversation, apparently, to create a strong bond amongst them. I don't know why that's relevant, but apparently it is. And according to him, they stop at every possible place and occasionally engage in quarrels. But near an electric plant, and just the last show, I was talking about, you know, the high incidence of phenomena popping up at electrical plants, you know, nuclear plants, that kind of stuff. They're near an electric plant when they decide to stop and stretch their legs. They've been on a very, very long drive. They both light cigarettes and begin to comment on the beauty of the sky and start talking about the roads of Arica, which they're about to drive along. Now, suddenly, they insist that there's thousands of little grains of light start to form a wall of luminosity just 50 meters from where they are. And toward, this is on the outside of the road, it's towards a ravine. And within this wall, this very tall, over 7 meter high being starts to emerge from it. Now they run back to their vehicle.
Out of the wall.
Like out of this wall of luminosity. Now they run back to their car, they jump into the vehicle, they slam the doors, they lock it. They're thinking this is something out of a science fiction film. They don't know what this is, but their vehicle won't start. Their electrical interference is stopping their vehicle from starting. I'm sorry, I said that the being was 7 meters. The height of the wall was 7 meters. The being was closer to 4 meters tall, right?
Oh, we've just gone from a 7 foot Adonis
different meters.
To a little electrical manlet.
It's still 4 meters tall. That's twice the height of you and
me. Sorry, my mistake. Yeah, I thought you meant 4 feet.
So this, no, meters. So this thing, you know, they emerges from this wall. He finally gets his car to start. You know, Sergio gets the car to start. And he starts to run, he's in a panic, right? And this being, this gigantic being just starts kind of meandering across the road. Serge runs it over.
Nice.
It's just like he's in a panic. It's based. He doesn't know what to do.
What does the being look like? Well, can we get a description, please?
It's just a luminous 4 meter tall being, like humanoid being. Oh,
that's
emerged. That's
really helpful.
Again, like there's no other details that's included. But this is where there is a fascinating detail which is included because when he rams into this being, right? Apparently, it disperses like a hail of small branches all over the truck's hood. So I'm imagining it's like a arcing electricity, but like thousands of little ones going everywhere. They smash this thing. It completely smashes and they drive off.
So these are the electric men. This is what you described in the,
yes.
Or what was in the introduction.
Yes. So as they drive off though, Topo turns around and looks out the back window to see what it is. He claims that as he's watching and screaming that the being reconstitutes itself. Like it reforms in all these little electrical kind of forms and then it climbs back into this wall of luminosity and the wall of luminosity just goes and closes, right? Now, no one's going to believe the story. Both of them, Sergio and Topo, are like, no one's going to believe this story. They were discussing it amongst themselves, but they were horrified. You know? Like, and of course you would be because how do you explain something like this? But they still drive to the police station. But by the time they get to the police station, they're like, okay, first of all, no one's going to believe us. Secondly, they're going to run alcohol tests. They're going to, you know.
Also, they are both blind drunk at
the
stage.
No, nothing like that. And that's not said, but the fact that they're worried that they're going to run alcohol tests makes me wonder if they've had a couple of drinks maybe. But again, like as I always say, it's pretty rare for alcohol to cause these sorts of hallucinations that they both experience, that you know, two people experience. So they both calm down and they're like, okay, that's fine. Until Sergio, as he's driving along, he realizes that when he was trying to start the car in the panic and his window was down, he'd left his arm kind of on the door as he's trying to start. And as he does, and he's driving off, he realizes that there's this burn mark, like an electrical burn
burnt
on his arm. And it's like, how the hell did I get this?
It's now, not a sunburn. It's actually an
electrical burn. No, it's an electrical burn. It's some type of like a, you can see an indentation, almost like a little, I'm not going to say a spark directly.
Well, the reason I say sunburn is because in a lot of these weird encounters, people report that they have some kind of skin irritation, like they've been under the sun for too long.
And there are those sorts of stories in here. There's plenty of stories of people that see UFO. And I didn't include them because like they are great, but there's just like, I want to go for the more unusual experiences. There's a whole heap of stories of people saying, a UFO landed on a road in front of me. I turned my face, you know, away from it.
Any orb stories?
Oh, Ben, do I have orbs for you?
God.
Do I have orbs? In fact,
blow my brains out.
Where was it? In fact, I've got this new thing. So they're not orbs anymore. There's actually a term for them, which was called, let me see if I can find it for you, Ben.
Boring spheres. Spheres of boredom.
It's a Repkin.
What?
A Repkin, a residual psychic quasi-intelligent energy. Apparently, these globular lights appear to be endowed with some form of intelligence and are capable of outright malice. This term was christened by Spanish researcher Salvador Fresedo. He was convinced that these beings, whatever they are, these light globes, are essentially the transport mechanisms for these shape-shifting entities that appear all across the Spanish-speaking world. And of course, you know, we know that Fresedo, you know, has done excellent work in recording the experiences from the Spanish-speaking world. And in fact, you know, Fresedo, we need to pull up more of his books a little bit later on because that, in the future, because, I mean, again, like just, we've only done one of his books, which is translated to English. But let's continue with some of these cases. So there was a well-known doctor that was traveling with his son near Arica. This was the summer of 1987, but when I say he was traveling with his son was traveling ahead of him and they were in separate vehicles. Now, the son was ahead by at least a kilometer, at least. But upon reaching Arica, the son was startled to see that his father's car was parked on the side of the road. And he's like, and it's been a long journey. Like, it's been a really long journey. And he's like, hang on a second. I was at least a kilometer ahead of you. You know, no mobile phones that they were using back then to be able to coordinate. And he's like, how the hell did he get ahead of me? Like, how did he arrive before I arrived? There's only one road. There's only one highway. I didn't see him pass me. So he walks up and opens the car door and he finds his father deeply asleep. Now he wakes his father up and his father can't contribute anything to how he got there, what happened, except for this last memory, he says. Much like the story I told at the start of the show, he said, as he was driving along, suddenly the vehicle was shrouded in a strange cloudiness that seemingly pulled the vehicle into it. Now, it's like, that's strange. Like, he's driven into this fog and he seemingly is teleported. They also find out that not only has the father actually arrived before the son, there's 100 kilometers missing from the odometer. Now, he knows the odometer because he said that the doctor would regularly have this thing of checking the car's oil. And so, of course, they went to check. And he's like, there's 100 kilometers missing, even though he had arrived before his son. So it's like this weird, not only missing time, but this teleportation event. The doctor doesn't remember anything at that point except for feeling sleepy. The presence of the cloud just disappeared.
How would checking the oil reveal kilometers? Do they mean petrol? Do they mean
the
gas?
No, apparently, well, maybe it's the translation again, but he says he notes the mileage to check the performance and quality of the purchased product. So maybe he's only retentive about oil, I don't know. But somehow, because of that detail, they were able to work out that there was 100 kilometers missing on the odometer. It was 100 kilometers less of what it should be. And there are people out there that are like that. I knew someone in uni who wouldn't give anyone a lift, like anywhere, because he thought it would cost more in petrol.
Yeah, that's gas, like, not oil.
Oil, who knows? Who knows? I mean, just translate it for yourself if you want to find out more details. Then we come to the case of practical archaeology. This relates to a teacher from Kalamar. He was an archaeology teacher, obviously. And on this particular excursion, he decided that rather than teaching in the class, he wanted to take everyone to a site. So he and two other teachers in the entire class go out to this particular site. The details of exactly where the site is are not included here. But they're having this on-field discussion, and one of the students notices that there are two strangers of great height in the adjacent work area. And it's just odd, right? Because they're a bit, they're not tourists. They're something else. And of course, the entire class looks over and they claim that they can see them deep in a ravine. And it's almost like they're shadows, like they're silhouettes, but they're just odd. And as these teachers and students are looking, they just suddenly disappear. Like they just suddenly go. Now, this panic kind of ensues amongst all the witnesses because there's no caves or terrain in this ravine for them to disappear into. It's completely smooth. And yet somehow these 3 meter tall silhouettes, but they could make them out. Apparently they were dressed in jumpsuits of some kind, just suddenly appear and disappear. Now, what's is described here is apparently there are other cases of people seeing exactly the same beings in this very area in Arica, which is associated with these mineral deposits. So what are they? You know, are they, is it a dimensional?
They sound dangerous. I don't trust them.
I don't know what it is. I don't know what this is. But
that's why I always carry one of these around whenever I'm out in the wilderness in Spain or Chile.
That is not helpful.
Just in case I come across something and I've just about had it with them, I will take one of those with me.
Let's skip forward. Okay. So now we go to the lake. This is the second largest of the Chilean lakes. It covers approximately 870 square kilometers. This is the Llanquihue Lake. And apparently some of the phenomena which has been seen here dates back all the way to the 1500s when it was actually first discovered. But apparently the term means to plunge or to fall into. And this might be more telling about what's really going on, because there's multitudes of reports from the late 1960s through to the mid-1970s of people just simply disappearing, vehicles like boats and all, on this particular lake, and they're never found again. Now, of course, these things can happen. You know, there's bodies of water, people disappear, accidents happen. But for there to be so many of them, even if it was a notably treacherous body of water, it's just strange. Like, it's beyond coincidence. And some people believe that there's some type of interdimensional rift here, which is being utilized by extra-dimensional beings.
Why do they believe that?
Because of the experiences that people have. There's a multitude of fishermen and other people that work on this lake that claim to see UFOs emerging. They have experiences of encountering beings. There's weird lights that appear over the lake that are so common that they're regularly reported and become just kind of a usual thing for people to describe. A really great example comes from the fisherman Vargas. He claims on August the 23rd in 1978 to witness a kind of boat, but it was more like an aluminium egg. It was 5 meters long with a dome on the top, and it suddenly emerged from the lake. Subsequently, numerous witnesses actually confirmed seeing exactly the same thing. But what was left in this time was a four meter diameter sulfuric stain on the top of the water.
Gross.
I'm like, yeah, this is gross, right? But apparently, Vargas had a continuing set of experiences on this lake. He took his son out. This is March of 1982. So he'd just seen this UFO emerge from the lake. He apparently took his son out, 14-year-old son, Juan Carlos. And as they go out, they claim to... Well, actually, no, what we know about... I shouldn't say they claim. Other witnesses claim, because there were strange lights that were seen upon this lake, but the two men were never seen again. Just disappeared. So he's had a UFO experience. He goes back out. He takes his son out. And they just disappear. What is found, I was going to say 60 days, but it's actually more than that. It's months later. Incidentally, the boat is found adrift. It's got unexplained circular burns on the deck. Circular burns, like precise circular burns. Now, this was investigated, and the police actually noted it as being a case of home abandonment. But apparently, locals say that the fisherman was deeply competent. He loved his work. He loved his family. Why would he leave like that? He didn't have any, you know, financial difficulties or any other family reasons to do so.
So they're saying he just left everything behind. Yeah. He left all his possessions and disappeared with his son.
Why would a fisherman abandon his work tool or try to burn it? And not just burn it, but burn it in a very strange way.
Oh, so it's like an insurance job or something.
Yeah, that's maybe one of the things that came up. But he says, you know, men engage in rough tasks like this. They don't go looking for a fresh start in this way.
Men engage in rough tasks. Now, that's GPT, if ever I've heard it.
Yeah, the way that that's translated that. But of course, you know, there's been multitudes of similar experiences in this very area. And this is why people are suggesting that it's like some type of cover for possibly beings. I don't know exactly what they're describing here, whether they're extraterrestrial, interdimensional, but multitudes have disappeared. There's also a story from... I think it was the Vargas. So Vargas, we'll bring it up here. So Vargas, who was the son, so Gabriel Vargas was the son of Baldovino Vargas, who was the man who disappeared. So this is another son. He claims that he had also seen UFOs, and he had a testimony of an experience that he himself had. He said that there were people in the town that were left speechless in 1988, precisely on January the 11th. Where three people, two young children, 10, 12, and a man that was 20 years old, they go for a walk in the surrounding region. So it's not in the lake, but they're going in the surrounding area. It just, and listen to this, It just so happens that lunchtime arrives and a storm sweeps in. The storm just suddenly comes out of nowhere, and the children and the young man never return. 2 years have passed, and no one has seen or heard of them since.
So they drowned in the storm.
They just simply disappeared. Well, they weren't out in the water, though. They were just in this area. Now, this is the thing, right? Again, this has got a missing 411 feel to it, because they go for a walk. The area is combed by police, firefighters, local patrols, people interested in helping. It was one of the most desperate searches in recent years. Even a helicopter was brought in to traverse the skies. They found nothing. The helicopter even had thermal equipment on board, which was, you know, quite advanced for the time. They were unable to find anything. They searched this area backwards and forwards, and nothing was ever found. So it's like, this is strange. Like, this is, and of course, this area, which is associated with disappearances. He says, you know, that this is a loose end that cannot be separated from the strangeness of the area. But then,
is there more missing people in that region that would make it suspicious rather than just one odd account?
Apparently, over the year, there have been at least 20 people that have disappeared from this area.
In 1 year?
Over the years, there have been 20 people that have disappeared in suspicious circumstances.
Is it like it's a large area?
It's a large
wilderness?
Natural wilderness area. Yeah, so, look, that's all possible. But of course, then you've got sightings of lights, sightings of UFOs, people having strange experiences in this place, the possibility of it being an interdimensional zone. It suggests that there's something more going on here. And of course, because the lake is, you know, known as to fall or dive in, it suggests that there's more to it here, that this is somehow, it's like the name, like what's in a name, and places that are called like Devil's Hill and that kind of stuff have strange activity associated with them. The fact that this is to dive in, what are they diving into? And he says, you know, with these stories, you know, with 20 people at least, it's very concerning for a UFO investigator because nothing remains. He's right. There's nothing. So then...
It wasn't a pair of shoes that showed up?
No, there's nothing like that. There's nothing that has that missing 411 element to it. But these stories are around. And of course, you know, he does reference. He says, look, there's strange coincidences here that come back to the Vargas case with Baldovino. He says, look, maybe this is nothing, like maybe, but all this kind of stuff, like this phenomenon, it does have these weird coincidences that's attached to it. That it's almost like it's the phenomenon goading us, or, you know, maybe leaving breadcrumbs for us to follow. But he says, look, this incident that happened, it just happened to be the anniversary of the disappearance of the Mary Celeste. It's like, yeah, like the Mary Celeste. We know that its sails deployed, the clothes were hung on deck, there was steaming cups of tea in the cabins, there was a musical score ready to go. And yet no living person was found aboard this vessel. Now, he also adds this strange detail, which isn't well known about the Mary Celeste. Apparently, underneath the Mary Celeste, strange red stains were found that at first people took to be blood. It was later analyzed by scientists of the time, so obviously, you know, limited science. But it was found that the substance was not blood indeed, but something that was unknown. They also found these strange indentations amongst the vessel. And apparently it smelt of sulfur.
There it is again. That sulfur smell. I can hear you. You need to take a drink. I can hear your voice breaking. Yes. So we're going to take a little break and listen to the bicentenary.
Clive, but maybe we could go to some croc experts who are a bit closer to the action right now.
It's Australia Day, remember?
Well, there's a man up there on the Adelaide River I'd like you to meet, Yana. His name's Brian Walsh, and I think he's just he's caught a small one now.
Oh, Bazza, I know Bazza.
A croc.
I think you're a bit busy, aren't you? Yeah, would you like me to...
typical Australian. The guy's wrangling a deadly crocodile. He's like, oh, you're right, mate.
He's not a munchie, of course. It's a crocodile, not a shark. It just looks like a shark.
This is live TV in the 1980s.
The world was a better place back then, Ben.
Brian,
he's trying to wrangle a croc over the side of this little teeny boat.
Entire area.
The cameras are
spinning
on him.
Around and around and around and around.
It looks like Steve Irwin's dad or something.
And his main job is to find crocodiles in the wrong place, like, for example, Darwin Harbour, and transport them to the right place, like a long way up the Adelaide River. And I think it's supposed to be a long time before they get back down to the harbour again.
But it's funny watching this because they've got like 4 hours to fill.
Can you answer the question while you're doing that?
Yeah. And it's just filler. The whole thing is filler.
How many birds have you got up there now in the area?
In the Darwin Harbour?
Yeah. No, in the whole area, the whole river. How many is there?
He's trying to interview the guy.
Look at the camera.
He's trying to interview the guy. The guy's literally wrangling a crocodile, and he's got an earpiece in, and he's meant to take and answer the questions.
How many crocodiles are there in the whole area?
1,600 in the Adelaide. We'll just get this tied up.
I'm a bit bloody busy right now, mate. Can't you see I'm a bit busy?
Okay, let's go back to a couple of these cases before we return to our Australia Day special. So let me bring up, actually, again, this fog that comes through. So July 1968, there's a man by the name of Casimiro, and he was driving, again, in a truck. Like, these truck stories just keep on coming up, totally separate section of the book. As they're driving, they're suddenly enveloped by a thick fog. Now, he activates the truck's high beams. When he activates the high beams, he suddenly distinguishes a little man of about 60 centimeters in height standing on the side of the road. He's illuminated, like he's luminous, but not by the light reflecting from him. He's actually self-illuminated. He says that he kind of, because he's so bright, he turns away, but he says the image is etched in his mind. He can distinguish a disc sitting just behind him. He's got a belt buckle on that's kind of glowing as well. There's a hat on his head of some weird kind. You can't make out what it is. And he says that this is just like shocking to see this thing on the side of the road. Now, what's fascinating is that apparently there were lights seen in the area from other reports at exactly the same time. So this is not just a simple hallucination that some guy's having, but the clouds come back. Like, these weird clouds coming up in these stories is that, and I was reading later on in some of these reports, and there's been multitudes of people seeing weird in South America. There's this kind of section of reports of mushroom clouds, right? And I thought, what does it mean by mushroom clouds? So I read forward a little bit, and with these mushroom clouds, over the years, people just suddenly see these nuclear-like clouds that just suddenly appear out of nowhere, and they go up into the sky. And when they go up into the sky, they see lights and craft coming in and out of them before they completely dissipate. And the suggestion is that whatever these beings are, they're utilizing clouds as some type of mechanism as camouflage. Like, they can allow themselves to pass in and out of wherever they're going through these clouds. And that's why you have fogs coming up in so many of these reports, because it's literally the camouflage for their transport mechanism, whatever that may be.
Pretty effective camouflage. But if you look at the history of UFO sightings, it doesn't indicate that they need it. They can come and go as they please. Invisible or visible is up to them.
Maybe the technology's changed.
I don't think, I'm just really tired, but I'm so bloody skeptical of all your stories today. Like, I'm just listening to that, I'm just going, okay, so people are seeing lenticular clouds and what, a storm's brewing?
But no, there's craft coming out of them. That's the difference. People are actually seeing craft. Sometimes they're arc-shaped craft, other times there's no triangles that come up, but normal, the standard saucer-type craft that are coming out of them. And they're being seen by so many people. And this is the thing that really stands out. Now, of course, you know, going through this book, later on, it starts doing things like talking about weird stuff that people have seen on the moon, you know, Spanish researchers. There's also, you know, weird disappearances of UFO researchers, of course, after they start, you know, meddling in this kind of stuff. You know, those sorts of things come up. But there was one thing that was really shocking about this, which again demonstrates that this is a global phenomenon. And this is mutilations, like livestock mutilations. But this is in the early 90s, Jorge writes, that I came across testimony which was corroborated in all respects from a multitude of sources. And it really is a shocking element to these cases. He said this army guy that came to him and was describing about, you know, some of the mutilations that he had found. And I think there was one particular story, which I don't have directly in front of me now, but it's like the army somehow was familiar with what was going on, but they weren't obviously telling their soldiers. But apparently this army guy claimed that one day he was sent up to go and inspect what appeared to be a smoking something in the distance. And he goes up, and when he goes up, he finds that it's like two animals are mutilated. And it doesn't say what the animals are, but it's like a cattle mutilation, I'm assuming. But these animals were severely mutilated. But he said what was strange is that they were mutilated, but their remains were placed directly in the center of this cone-shaped hole which had been drilled out of the ground. Like, it was this massive cone-shaped hole.
The hell?
And there was smoke coming up out of it. It's not like someone could have dug it. It was like this perfect, like someone had fired a laser in there to cut out this massive earth and remove it and then dump a couple of llamas in there, like, that are mutilated in the quarterized laser fashion kind of thing. I was like, okay, that's weird.
Maybe so they thought they were cows and they started mutilating them. They're like, what the hell are these? And they threw them back.
Well, maybe that happened, because apparently later on, when he was speaking to another witness, this is the one he was saying that I've, in all respects, I've corroborated, in the years of 77 to 88, there were llama mutilations occurring across the country. And he said there was one particular witness that came forward and said that he found three llamas that were mutilated. But what was odd is that their heads were completely shaved, but nowhere else. Like, who shaves a llama, let alone three of them? And like, you know, like, I don't know if you've ever hung around llamas, but those things.
Oh, I've hung around llamas, my friend.
They get pretty pissed off if you try to agitate them. So it's not easy to shave one of these things. But three of them, they were all the typical mutilations, like the Linda Moulton Howe style mutilations. Not in the sense that they had large breasts, but the fact that they were mutilated and cauterized. But then they were shaved. Their heads were completely shaved. And he said this was a really compelling part of the case because the area where the llamas were found, of course, there was no blood. There was no blood anywhere. There were no human tracks. There were no vehicle tracks. And these animals were found within a few hours of them clearly dying. And people had been in that area previously. No one saw anything happen. And these are people, he writes, that have limited economic resources. These were their main sources of their livelihood. So why would they come in with surgeons, essentially, and mutilate their own money supply, really? And of course, there was an autopsy or necropsy that was conducted by many of these in the area. And they did establish that the tool that was used in these cases had two qualities. One was that this tool was a combi tool of some kind in that it both cut and cauterized at exactly the same moment. A type of technology which really wasn't readily available for the fields of Chile. He says also there were disciplinary measures for other soldiers that tried to talk about these experiences. They were told that they would have their ranks reduced, but there was a lot of this activity going on with Highland animals. And he's like, what's happening with these things? Because, and how is bleeding being avoided? How are they being shaved? Only the plateau knows.
Skinhead llama cover-ups. That should have been your,
maybe,
your headline.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. It's just, it's very, very strange with what's going on in this particular area. And look, this book is just full of these cases.
What's the title again?
So it's Ovnus. I'm leaving it that. I'm just leaving.
Now, what's the rest
How do you
it?
Pronounce the Y? What's the Y? Is it, how does that
I
pronounce?
Have no idea.
Yeah, turn it back on you. There you go.
Oh, I'm not saying that. At least I know what Jorge is.
Well, I didn't know what Jorge was. There you go. I should have known that though. You're totally right. But look, what I want to go into, so
extraterrestrials. Otros en Chill.
Next time I'm just going to give you chill-y. The book and you could just translate it and we'll see how it goes. Now, of course, you know, in this particular region of the world, there's also been a collection of BHMs. These are big, hairy.
What?
I just saw that.
I didn't do anything. There was nothing on the screen. It was just the cover of the book. What are you talking about?
Okay, so this particular region of the world is known also for its encounters with big, hairy monsters, BHMs. So it's not just people seeing UFOs and interdimensional phenomena. And we're only just talking about Stan Gordon, who really, you know, put it into our minds about the connection between UFOs and BHMs. The exact same thing seems to be happening in this area where people are seeing these hairy type beings connected with UFOs as well. So the area is really a hotbed for this kind of stuff. But there's a really classic tale that I want to finish this segment on. I want to go into more of the psychic elements of this, but I realize we're running a little bit long.
Your voice is dying. It's Australia Day.
My voice is,
you're just about given up.
I've been screaming Aussie, 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 oi, 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 like out the window for an hour before we started recording. Like, no one responded, but still, like now
I don't even have a glass of water on the table. What are you doing?
Oh,
you got your jug underneath.
I got my jug. I'm like, yeah, don't put it in the shot. So
don't put it in the shot.
Let me just finish this one story for you. Okay, so this relates to the story of Corporal Valdez. Is it? Corporal Valdez. We know this story actually from the past. I think many, many years ago you described it, but we only went into it in a small amount of detail. But it's fascinating because it does.
Is his military rank Valdez?
No, maybe, but it's similar in the sense that it suggests that the military also knows that something is going on, but what exactly, no one knows. The crux of this story is in the second half of May in 1977, there was a huge amount of UFO activity that was going on in the region about 150 kilometers from the city of Arica. So again, the same kind of area. It's a little bit further out, but same kind of area. For whatever reason, the military was deployed up into these remote highlands where there's been cattle mutilations, sightings of UFOs, strange lights, all that kind of stuff that was going on. Now, this man, this Valdez, disappeared. Like, he just disappeared. But he disappeared for 15 minutes, right? So not a huge deal, but essentially what had happened was, we know the story in the sense that the guy comes back, right? And he was clean shaven.
This is the classic story where he's got stubble.
Yeah,
when
he was clean shaven when he left. He was gone for 15 minutes. When he came back, he had a 5 days of stubble of, you know, hair growing on his face. It's like, how is that even possible?
And his watch was frozen.
I looked at his watch. His watch was also missing 5 days of the calendar. Mm. Well, it was 5 days ahead on the calendar. So what we don't, what I didn't know about this case was that apparently, and according to this book, is that there's more to it in that they were, apparently these military guys were deployed to go and have a look at whatever this UFO activity was. They didn't know what they were looking for. These were the orders that were given to them. When they saw some type of beam of light shooting down around the particular area, this they were running after the light. Now, when he ran after the light, apparently this light suddenly fell on top of him. When the light fell on top of him, he fell through the ground. Like he went...
What?
He went down with this light, right? He said it was like falling through a fluorescent tube. He doesn't know exactly what it was.
I can't remember that detail.
Yeah, no, I hadn't read that at all, right? So he fell down between that tube. Now, the guy, when he came back, he was hysterical. He was like, don't let the light get me. He was absolutely shocked. But we find out later on that he actually went to a witness. So he went to a witness who is mentioned in this book. His name's Padro Adrenya. Now, apparently he was one of the first civilians to get any details about this because for whatever reason, Valdez must have felt comfortable with him and went and told him about what had happened on that particular evening. And obviously because he'd calmed down, he was able to describe, but he says essentially that this UFO had been sitting there and it had been freaking them all out. And this light seemingly was searching for something. And this light is what grabbed hold of him and pulled him through. Now, when he got pulled through, he goes into this space. Now, he's not exactly sure of where he went, but he did bring back a piece of metal.
He brought back this old story again.
A piece of metal, which is not mentioned in any of the other stories, right? Now, this piece of metal looked like a blade from the rotor of some kind of engine, but not. It couldn't be identified. It didn't fit with any known car fan. And it was also made of an unknown metal.
You would think we would have heard these details over the years if more, if this was an accurate report.
Maybe. I don't
know. Sounds like a more embellished report than normal.
This correspondence, there was a man by the name of Louis Duroy. Now, Louis Duroy was actually had the got hold of the sample and he had it analyzed, right? And he had this sample analyzed and was identified as initially as aluminium, but it had no signs of oxidization, obviously no rust. And it clearly had broken off some other part. But later on, it was said that it wasn't aluminium, but they weren't able to determine exactly what the metal was. The strange thing about this is that when the more questions came up from other researchers to get details about this, apparently the guy that held it, this Duroy, disappeared. He disappeared.
Mm.
So it's like, is the military covering this stuff up? Like, is that what's...
Sounds like the story I've got coming up in Plus with this Kiwi guy who developed something strange, and he disappeared as well.
Interesting. What's happening to these people?
He turned up on an island.
Are they being taken to some weird breakaway civilization island? Like, is that what's happening to these
people? He was definitely taken to some island. I've got the details. I've got the scoop.
Okay. I got the scoop. All right. Well, that's coming up right after this. Of course, I'll link to this book in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org. I will go into it in a little bit more detail on Tuesday because there's more of the psychic element. Yes, get that off. The more of the psychic elements that come in. Ben's favorite topic will be coming up. We're going to go into the Repquin, the residual psychic quasi-intelligent energy orbs and what they shapeshift into. But before we go, Ben, do you have any more Australia Day content?
Let's do it. Hey, that's the wrong one. Where is it? Yeah, it'd be good if it had sound. See, I've had like an hour's sleep.
As the years went. Not Olivia Newton-John.
Is that who it is? I was wondering if it was her.
I think it is. Oh, get me out of the 80s. I'm done now.
Yeah, I wanted to go back, but...
You can never go back.
Look at the decor.
I think we had that kind of furniture when I was a kid.
Where's Dame Shut Edna? Up, baby.
It can't be Australia Day without Dame Edna. Like,
she's in there somewhere.
Is she?
Yeah, because I was watching it.
Oh, there you go.
I was watching it going, oh, I just want to return to the 1980s. And then there's just like a man in drag.
Difficult for me to concentrate on this gorgeous new novel by an up-and-coming author. Oh, what a pity that you had to show a photograph of Madge. She's my old bridesmaid and constant travelling companion, viewers. And she's undergone a pretty nasty bout of highly unsuccessful cosmetic surgery.
There's a woman sitting next to her who's just wrapped up like a mummy. It's not very funny. Like, she doesn't really have any gags. It's just the funny thing is it's Dame Edna.
It's a man dressed as a woman.
A man with a wig.
Now look at the world we live in.
Yeah, so coming up in our Plus extension right after this, we're going to be talking about Victor Penny's death ray, this strange New Zealand individual, this self-taught engineer who was found beaten to death, mumbling about stolen secret plans.
Was beaten to death then?
Sorry, did I say so tired?
That's all right.
Beaten to near death.
Oh, near death.
Yeah, complaining that his plans had been stolen. And then he kind of vanished after that. So there was a huge media circus surrounding this. We're going to try and get to the bottom of what happened, if there was any truth to what he was trying to develop. And look at this conspiracy surrounding the development of death rays, especially in the 1920s and 30s, and some of the history there. For example, did you know the British military had a long-running competition at the start of the 20th century? It was running for, I think, over a decade, where they offered £5,000 if you could vaporize a sheep.
You know what? I'm not surprised. I didn't know that, but I'm not surprised because I was reading only the other day, I think it was on the Observer's Substack, where they were talking about the origins of the Philadelphia experiment, right? And how like this all been turned into being this really sensationalized kind of story. But if you look, you find a whole bunch of scientists that were experimenting with some really weird stuff at the time. That kind of fits in with the same thing. Like the military was looking for everything that they could get an edge.
Well, they got a lot of people that tried to show up and take the £5,000 by destroying killing a sheep with a death ray. No one was ever successful. And I don't think any of them even got the wool to kind of ignite. Like nothing was possible at all. And the problem with a lot of these experiments is it required the sheep to stay in the same position.
And as if it's going to do
that. For like 15, 20 minutes and it wasn't allowed to move.
Yeah, obviously, it wouldn't have any military applications if you got to have someone stand there for 10 minutes.
But this New Zealand self-taught engineer, this Kiwi engineer, could be the exception.
Okay.
That's coming up in our Plus extension right after this. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. Get access to the big extensions we do on these shows every single Friday. And of course, Plus members get an exclusive show that comes out every Tuesday as well. You're getting more than double the content if you sign up for Plus. You also get a higher quality MP3 version of the show for our audio and a totally ad-free version of the show as well. And if you sign up for MU Max, you get access to our entire back catalogue as well, going back 16 years worth of shows. Again, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today, help support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. Happy Australia Day. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Plus extension, great to have you with us.